We're pleased, Judge Evans and I are pleased to have Judge Dow from the Northern District of Illinois sitting by designation today with us. So we're looking forward to his participation. We're ready to proceed with the first case this morning, which is In Re Airdrum Communications.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, I'm Jeffrey Clear. I'm counsel for the FCC in this matter. Your Honors, what's at stake in the appeal this morning is control of the debtor. The reorganization plan and the bankruptcy proceeding provides that such control will go to the largest unsecured creditor. And the issue in the case is whether the largest unsecured creditor is the FCC or the appellee TDS. The FCC's claims derive from the auction of licenses to provide wireless services. They were won by the debtor Aerodyne after Aerodyne outbid its competitors at an auction. Aerodyne very promptly reneged on the terms of the auction bid, having made only the initial down payment and two of the 40 installment payments contemplated by the terms of the auction transaction. The FCC is now owed in excess of $90 million as a result of that.
It really doesn't bear on the merits of this case, but just for information, what does this license provide to the purchaser?
There are 15 of them at issue, Your Honor, and they authorize the purchaser to provide wireless cell phone communication services. And that accounts.
They typically sell that to somebody else, or they.
There are different provisions. The provisions at issue here were the licenses, rather, at issue here were auctioned in furtherance of a congressional determination that there had been too much concentration in large corporate hands of these licenses, and it directed the FCC to set aside a portion of the wireless spectrum for auction so that smaller businesses and disadvantaged entities would have an opportunity to obtain them. Aerodyne, along with a number of other competitors, bid on the licenses. Aerodyne was the winning bidder in gaining the right to have those licenses over its competitors. It reneged, however, on the terms of its auction, on the terms of the auction, and has paid the FCC very little of the auction price. The FCC is now owed in excess of $90 million under those transactions. The bulk of that claim is unsecured, and that is because the FCC took a security interest in the licenses, but the bankruptcy court determined that the value of the licenses had substantially diminished over the course of the bankruptcy proceeding, thereby leaving the FCC with a large unsecured claim. We submit that it is the largest unsecured claim, and that under the terms of the reorganization plan, the largest unsecured creditor gets a equity interest in the reorganized debtor in proportion to the amount of this unsecured claim, and because the FCC is the largest unsecured creditor, the FCC should have control of the debtor's remaining assets. TDS disagrees. It asserts that it is the largest unsecured creditor. It bases this contention on some claims that were submitted in the prior bankruptcy proceeding. Some of its claims are predicated on cash advances made to the debtor during the course of the bankruptcy. Other claims are predicated on claims asserted by different creditors that TDS subsequently obtained through assignment arrangements with these other creditors. It's our principal contention in this case that none of TDS's claims are in fact based on a bona fide right to payment, and that they do not give rise to an unsecured claim. There is an important threshold issue in the case as to whether the FCC has preserved its right to raise such an objection in the case. The parties entered a stipulation designed to facilitate the commencement of a second bankruptcy proceeding. There are terms in the written terms of the stipulation that address which kinds of claims can be asserted in the second bankruptcy proceeding. And TDS maintains that principally on the basis of these written terms that the FCC has waived any right to object to the allowance of TDS's unsecured claims here. The bankruptcy court thought that there had been no such agreement. It recognized that the written terms of the stipulation were problematic for the FCC, but it noted that the parties had come to the court to get the court's approval of the terms of this stipulation. They had stated to the bankruptcy court at a hearing on the record, at a hearing designed to apprise the court of the meaning of this stipulation and the intent of the parties, that the terms of the stipulation had been modified, and that the oral modifications, as represented by counsel for both the debtor and by counsel for TDS, suggested that all rights had been reserved, that except for matters of interest, other unresolved questions remained to be decided in the court. The bankruptcy court's view was that at a minimum, there was so much contradictory and confusing statements as to what rights had been preserved and what rights had in fact been extinguished by a waiver, that it could not find on the totality of the record an intent to waive the FCC's rights to object here.
Counsel, could I ask you, what's left of the written agreement then? I mean, I was a little confused by that because you've got a written agreement with these paragraphs, and then you've got this colloquy with the judge, and the judge suggests maybe you guys want to go and rewrite this, and I don't think anyone takes the judge up on that. So instead, what you're left with is something in writing, something stated orally, and the oral is maybe subject to an interpretation that everything's left open. If that's true, then what was closed by what was submitted in writing?
Well, Your Honor, I think what's left of the written stipulation is what really was the essential intent, at least of the FCC, which was simply to ensure that the commencement of the second proceeding would not prejudice the parties' rights as they had been established in the first proceeding. I think there really is no argument that the written terms of the written stipulation and the terms of the oral comments made by counsel are inconsistent. The court's view was that the oral comments were intended to modify the written stipulation, not simply to stand on the same footing. And that is why when the bankruptcy judge approved the terms of the stipulation, he entered a handwritten notation stating that the stipulation was approved as modified, not simply as clarified or explained on the record, but as modified by the oral remarks of counsel.
Words, and I got four paragraphs here. Is there anything in there that, and I'll be interested in your adversary's view of that too, but what's left of that? Or why wasn't it just withdrawn if that's what was intended?
Well, Your Honor, perhaps that would have been the better course of action. And as Your Honor has pointed out, the bankruptcy judge on several occasions at this hearing asked the parties if they didn't really want to go back and redraft the written stipulation to incorporate the changes that had been articulated orally and to better reflect the party's intent. As to what's left, certainly the introductory paragraph stating that the rights of the parties are in no way prejudiced by the closing of the case is left. Bear in mind, Your Honor, if you would, that this is a stipulation entered to resolve the FCC's objection to the commencement of the second proceeding in the first instance. That the FCC's principal reservation was that rights that had been established in the first proceeding might be unraveled by the commencement of the second proceeding. However, inartfully drafted from the FCC's perspective, its intent was simply to maintain the status quo and to ensure that the commencement of the second proceeding would not again unravel rights that had been established in the first proceeding. That is certainly how the bankruptcy court has understood it. It did not regard the written terms as controlling. This is a determination we submit that is entitled to special weight here on appeal. The bankruptcy judge had long experience with this difficult and complicated case. The oral remarks the bankruptcy court judge relied upon were not simply oral statements reported to the parties by the parties, but oral statements made to the judge at a hearing to explain the meaning and purpose of this stipulation. They were intended to induce the bankruptcy court judge to sign it. In that circumstance, we would think that the bankruptcy court judge's determination ought to have deference here in appeal. The bankruptcy court judge felt that we, the FCC's right to object, had at a minimum not been extinguished by this stipulation, and it was appropriate to reach the merits. unless the court has further questions about the stipulation, I'd like to proceed to the merits, if I might. There are three claims that TDS has asserted that give rise to unsecured claims. The first one, denominated Claim 14, stems from cash advances that were made by TDS to Aerodyne over the course of the first bankruptcy proceeding. It is our contention that if you simply look at the terms of the first reorganization plan that placed TDS under the obligation to make these cash advances and that described the nature of the obligations that would flow from those cash advances, all that agreement says is that Aerodyne, in exchange for these cash advances, would agree to transfer to TDS its non-licensed assets. There is no discussion of a monetary obligation to make repayment of a principal amount of the cash advances with interest. It is, I think, the principal contention of TDS and the reasoning of both courts below that the terms of this transaction contemplated a non-recourse loan because they contemplated that the loan would be satisfied by the transfer of assets. That, we'd submit, really mistakes the fundamental nature of a non-recourse loan. Granted, in a non-recourse loan, if a debtor defaults, then the extent of the lender's remedy is only against the collateral. That is certainly true. But the right to the collateral is contingent on an underlying monetary obligation to make repayment of the interest and principal. Absent a default on that obligation, there is no right to the collateral. Absent a default on that obligation, the debtor has the right to satisfy the terms of the transaction with a cash repayment and to retain assets that secure the loan. In this case, those assets are the license, all the nine licensed assets that make it possible for the debtor to maintain its business. It is, I think, as a practical matter, an extremely important distinction here to note that the terms of this loan simply did not contemplate a cash repayment. By definition, by the express terms of the reorganization plan that authorized these payments, they contemplate only a transfer of non-licensed assets.
So at the end of the day, the only thing TBS would receive were the assets?
The assets, or in the event of a breach of that obligation, damages equal to the value of the assets. But there was simply no contemplation in the terms of the reorganization plan of a cash repayment. Aerodyne could not, under the terms of this agreement, satisfy its obligation to TDS by making a cash repayment and keeping the non-licensed assets. This, of course, makes sense when looked at from the perspective of the overall business strategy of TDS. This is essentially a plan to acquire control of the company. It had provisions under which TDS would get control of the licenses that made it possible to provide cell phone services. It had corollary provisions that made it possible for TDS to get control of the non-licensed assets that made it possible to make use of these licenses, I think. Obviously, what it wanted, it was the company and the ability to run it. It therefore made sense that it wanted the cell phone towers, the other equipment, and so forth, not simply a cash repayment.
Well, I suppose the argument, the argument is that this is what has been classified as restructuring, which isn't authorized in the bankruptcy code.
Your Honor, our position on appeal is that this is simply an asset purchase agreement and that the court does not have to get into the larger and, I think, thornier question as to whether something that's characterized as a debt can be recharacterized as equity. All we ask the court to do here, all we have asked the bankruptcy courts to do, is to look at the face of the agreement and decide whether this contemplates an asset purchase agreement or not. The court, we think, certainly, whatever the answer to the question of recharacterization may be, the court certainly has the power when looking at whether to allow or disallow a claim on an interested party's objection. The court certainly has the power to determine whether there is a bona fide claim in the first instance. The code defines a claim as a right to payment. The code empowers in Section 502 the bankruptcy court to rule upon an objection to the claim. All within those two provisions of the code, there is ample power to determine whether there is a right to payment or not. And for purposes of this proceeding, that is all we are asking the court to determine, to look at the substance of the transaction, not its form, to decide whether there really was an underlying monetary obligation to make the payment, or to decide instead, as we've argued in our briefs, that the only obligation created by these transactions was to make a transfer of assets, and that asset transfers cannot give rise to a claim, a monetary claim, for the full amount of the cash advances and the nominal interest described in the plan of reorganization. There are two other claims that under the TDS is advanced here, claims 15 and 16 as they have been denominated. They each turn on the assignment of claims other creditors had against Aerodyne to TDS. TDS now stands in the shoes of those other creditors and asserts claims that it asserts are monetary claims that are unsecured and that should be counted as unsecured claims. The first of these claims is claim 15. It concerns a claim pressed against Aerodyne by the Oneida Economic Development Administration. It was assigned to TDS, and it is governed by the terms of the first reorganization plan. Whatever OEDA was owed is governed by the first reorganization plan. That's what was assigned to TDS. As we've described in our briefs, what the first reorganization plan contemplated was that in the event the FCC did not make affirmative decisions to reinstate the licenses by 2002, the so-called backup provisions of the plan would control. Those backup provisions, in fact, provided for no further right to payment by the debtor to either Ericsson to OEDA or the other creditor at issue here. Ericsson, because there is no right to repayment under the first reorganization plan, TDS can succeed to no more than that. It therefore cannot assert an additional claim for monetary repayment based on these claims either. Your Honors, I see I'm into my rebuttal time. I would like to reserve it, if I might, unless the Court has further questions. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Ms. Furry.
Good morning. May it please the Court, I'm Catherine Furry, representing Telephone and Data Systems, Inc., in this appeal. Let me start first with a comment with respect to the stipulation of claims. At the outset, in the 1999 Aerodyne case, Aerodyne proposed to pay all of its creditors, including the Federal Communications Commission, in full with interest. The FCC, for a variety of regulatory reasons, elected not to accept payment in full, but instead to pursue other litigation. Ultimately, there was a delay in the decision to reinstate the licenses of Aerodyne, which led to the filing of the 2006 case. It was in that context that the parties reached the stipulation of claims. And not surprisingly, we disagree with the FCC with regard to the interpretation of the stipulation of claims. The statements that were placed on the record were as the transcript of that hearing on July 6th indicates, clarification. For example, there were certain defined terms by the use of initial caps, capital A allowed, capital C claim, that were used in the stipulation, but there was not a specific reference in the stipulation to the source of that definition. Accordingly, the court was advised that the parties had certain clarifications to place on the record with respect to the stipulation. And the first was that the term allowed claims had the meaning that was assigned to it and defined in the 2000 plan. Additionally, paragraph 4 of the stipulation says all other rights of the parties hereto, including the right of the FCC and TDS to claim interest, are reserved. It is a convenient argument to ignore the use of the word other, and we think that the stipulation must be construed in its entirety as it was by the district court. Paragraph 1 says, except as provided in the stipulation, rights are preserved. Paragraph 2 says that the claims of the FCC and TDS, both as the assignee of the OEDA and Erickson claims, which are claims 15 and 16, and of the claims associated with, quote, the claims of TDS arising from its advance of funds in accordance with the 2000 plan shall be allowed in the 2006 bankruptcy case in the amount of the loans with interest. Now, it's been pointed out in the briefs by the FCC that the proofs of claim that are the subject of this appeal were not filed until approximately 1 month after this stipulation was placed on the record. That doesn't mean that, at least with respect to claims 15 and 16, the FCC was not aware of the amount of the claims. Those claims were determined and allowed in the 2000 plan. Specifically, claim 15 was allowed in the 2000 plan in the amount of $49 million. So there was no surprise about the amount of claim 15. Claim 16 was allowed in the amount of $71 million, and after an initial $31 million payment, the remaining unpaid balance was $40 million. Those are the amounts that were allowed by the district court, and the $40 million Erickson claim is the amount that was allowed by both the district court and the bankruptcy court. The statements on the record are not at all inconsistent. The statements on the record were to clarify that paragraph 4, which says all other claims are reserved, is very broad. And as indicated in the record, although paragraph 4 talks about the right to include interest, subsequently the issue of the nature and extent of security for various claims was also a subject of litigation, part of which found its way to this court previously. And as this court previously found in its decision on interest on the FCC claims, the court stated that on June 6, the parties entered into a stipulation agreeing, among other things, that the FCC's allowed claims in the 1999 case shall be allowed in the 2006 case. This court continued that in exchange for the agreement, the FCC did not object to the closing of the 1999 case or the opening of the 2006 case. The court concluded that the stipulation further provided that all other rights of the parties hereto, including without limitation the right of TDS and AT&T, the FCC, to seek inclusion and allowance of interest, are expressly reserved. So we think that the record, the stipulation itself, and the decisions of the lower courts are very clear with respect to the stipulation of claims.
And do you think there's any inconsistency between what this court has said last year and what the bankruptcy court's reading of this?
Yes.
Okay.
And I don't think in this instance that the bankruptcy court's decision is entitled to any deference. I think the interpretation of the meaning of the stipulation is a matter of law that this court reviews de novo. I think that the district court, in exercising the same standard of review and analyzing the stipulation, reached the correct result, because any other interpretation would render the stipulation meaningless. And as may have been suggested earlier, there would have been no purpose to the stipulation. Certainly these are sophisticated parties. They are experienced counsel. And it is, I believe, unmistakable that the use of other rights, both in the clarifications on the record and in paragraph 4 of the stipulation, must mean that it excludes allowability and the face amount of the claims, the basic amount of the claims. Now, if I might, I'd like to turn to claim 14, which are the TDS loans. Those loans were made after the confirmation of the 2000 plan. And the 2000 plan does contain some, as characterized in the briefs before the court, general description of the nature and terms of those loans. Again, the plan itself calls those advances of funds loans, specifically a construction loan to permit Iridium to construct new cell towers to meet FCC requirements, a working capital loan, and a confirmation loan to permit it to emerge from bankruptcy and to fund its reorganization. At the time of the confirmation of the 2000 plan, Iridium was an operating company with over 30,000 customers, hundreds of employees, and providing service to areas and regions of the state of Wisconsin that otherwise had no phone service, no landlines. The only service they had was in the form of cellular communication. So they were an operating company, unlike many other of the companies that purchased licenses in these initial auctions. And they had a hopeful future, because at the time of the confirmation of the 2000 plan, if the FCC had timely acted to reinstate Iridium's licenses, the company was worth more than $245 million. If the FCC had timely acted to reinstate the licenses or to determine that its cancellation had been incorrect or improper or without foundation in law, not only would every creditor of Iridium, including the FCC, have been paid in full with interest, but the record confirms that there would have been over $60 million available to the equity security holders. And so we really did have a company in Chapter 11, the way Chapter 11 is supposed to work, that had a very hopeful future. But it had to get from the point of confirmation, awaiting a decision by the FCC, down the road so that that value could be realized. And therefore, the plan did provide for a series of loans. Now, it also did contain some provisions related to a purchase. But the purchase was not a purchase by TDS. It was a purchase by jointly AT&T and TDS that would occur in the event the licenses had been reinstated on or before June 30, 2001. And although the plan provided for general terms, that there would be loans in specific amounts or for specific purposes that would accrue interest at the rate of 8.5% per annum until paid, it would be a single payment of principal and interest. There was security provided for the loans. It was also contemplated that those loans would be documented in the form of true loans. And the record at Appendix 119, Appendix 204, Appendix 216, Appendix 134 all contain those loan agreements. Now, certainly Section 1.5 of each of those loan agreements does say that there will be a payment in the form of a surrender of collateral. But focusing solely on Section 1.5 ignores the material terms and provisions of each of the promissory notes that were signed by Iridium, and it ignores other material terms of the loan agreements themselves. Section 1.5A of each of the loan agreements says that the borrower promises to pay to TDS the specified sum of the loans, and additionally it says that to the extent not previously repaid, the outstanding principal balance together with accrued interest shall be paid in full as provided in Section 1.5D. There was no prohibition on Iridium making repayment. And in fact, the record confirms that there were some repayments made by Iridium. This is an instance where, had the facts been different, had the value of the licenses not decreased, there was nothing that prohibited Iridium from repaying the loans and retaining the collateral. If those licenses had gone up in value under the promissory notes and under the loan agreements, Iridium had the absolute right to make a repayment. It was simply a limitation that was recognized by everyone that if Iridium didn't own the licenses, there would be no other source of repayment but for surrender of collateral. And thus, this was structured as a non-recourse loan. under 101.5, this certainly meets the definition of a claim. Under 101.2 of the code, claim against the debtor includes a claim against property of the debtor. There has never been a dispute that TDS, with respect to Claim 14, has a claim against property of the debtor. It is a secured creditor. And under 1111B1A, even if that claim is non-recourse to property of the debtor, because, as in this case, Aerodyne proposed to retain the collateral, that claim is converted to a claim or a right to payment in the full amount of the loans, just as the parties had stipulated in the stipulation of claims. Now, Judge Martin, I think, did a superb job of analyzing the interplay of the provisions of Section 101, Section 102, and Section 502 related to the allowance of claims. And we believe, in this instance, his decision is entitled to full deference, because his decision on the meaning of Claim 14 and the TDS loans and his decision with respect to Claim 16 both derive from the terms and provisions of the 2000 plan that was confirmed by Judge Martin. As a plan he confirmed, his plan confirmation order and the plan itself are subject to full deference and should be overturned only if there is a clear abuse of discretion. We believe that his decision with respect to Claim 14 is entitled to that deference and is correct. It might be noted that at this point, the government is suggesting that Claim 14 should be viewed as a labeling issue. Was this really an asset purchase, or was it a series of loans? That was not an argument that was presented to Judge Martin. That was not an argument other than in a short reference in a heading in a brief that was presented to the district court. The argument in each of the lower courts was that the claim should be recharacterized as somehow equity. And again, in analyzing Section 502 and its application, Judge Martin step-by-step went through each of the nine exceptions that are found in Section 502 with respect to the allowance of claims and rejected each of those based on the facts in this case. They were sophisticated parties who knew and intended at all times that these be loans. The plans called them loans. They were documented as loans. They were reflected in the books and records of Aerodyne as loans, as reflected in item 23 at docket 11 and docket number 315. And the stipulation of claims also refers to them as loans. Now, briefly turning to Claim 16, Claim 16 is very similar to Claim 14. Claim 16 arises from pre-petition loans that were made by Erickson to Aerodyne prior to the filing of the 1999 case. And there was never any objection to those claims, nor was there ever any dispute that Erickson was a fully secured creditor at the filing of the 2000 plan and at the confirmation of the 2000 plan. In particular, Article 5 of the 2000 plan addresses and defines the Erickson claim, now known as Claim 16, and it provides that there shall be allowed a claim in the amount of $71 million. With respect to that claim, the plan was very clear. It provided that in the event the licenses were reinstated, Erickson would retain its lien until paid in full. The plan did not say if they're reinstated prior to the backup transfer date, they'll retain their lien. But if the reinstatement occurs after the lien disappears, it also provided that in the event the licenses were not reinstated, Erickson would retain its lien until paid in full. There is no provision in the 2000 plan for a discharge, release, or satisfaction of the lien of Erickson other than payment in full. Now, the bankruptcy court valued the licenses in this case, and had to go through the process because there are 15 separate licenses and 15 separate claims, evaluating each license. As evidenced by the order on the allowance of Claim 16 entered by Judge Martin, there is some security. So Erickson or Claim 16 is an undersecured secured claim. But it is a secured claim with an interest in licenses and proceeds of licenses. And unless and until they are paid in full, that is a claim that is recognized under the provisions of the Bankruptcy Code that must be satisfied and paid in this case. And again, under Section 1111B, because Aerodyne proposes to retain the licenses, that claim is converted into a full recourse claim. So even if there were no personal right after a certain date to seek payment in cash, there was a right and there continues to be a right to payment out of its collateral. And since Aerodyne proposes to retain the collateral, that claim was properly allowed by the bankruptcy court and approved by the district court. If there are no other questions, I will relinquish the balance of my time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Clare, how much time?
3 minutes.
You have 3 minutes, Mr. Clare.
Thank you, Your Honors. It has been a refrain throughout this case and throughout the other appeals before the court that if FCC had simply given back the licenses to Aerodyne, TDS would have honored its financial commitments and funded placed enough money in this estate to pay all creditors. What that argument ignores is that TDS, in conjunction with its buyer, AT&T, they're not small or disadvantaged enterprises that would otherwise be entitled to bid on these licenses. If the FCC were to have simply given back the licenses to Aerodyne under plan provisions that contemplated their transfer to TDS, it would have violated the objectives of setting aside these licenses for small businesses in the first instance, and it would have compromised the integrity of the auction process by allowing Aerodyne to control over the interest of other qualified bidders, licenses that Aerodyne simply never paid for. As to the waiver provision, as to the waiver issue and the oral remarks of counsel, the bankruptcy court simply did not construe the oral statements of counsel in the manner that's been represented to you today. Obviously, the judge was there. These were statements made to the judge to explain the party's intent, the purpose of the stipulation, what rights were intended to be reserved. We'd submit to the court that the bankruptcy judge in this situation really is in the best position to construe those remarks, and that that the court's determination on that issue ought to be accorded deference here. As to Claim 14, these are the cash advances made by TDS. A set of arguments have been made based on the terms of the promissory agreement, promissory notes, and the implementing loan agreements. I do not recall these arguments being made in the appellee's brief. In any event, these are all, the promissory note and the implementing agreements all follow the reorganization plan. They are entered into after the reorganization plan. The reorganization plan by statute is controlling on the debtor and the creditors. That's Section 1141A1, and the reorganization plan provides that these cash advances, quote, shall, close quote, be repaid by the transfer of the collateral. There is simply no contemplation in the reorganization plan of any right to make a cash repayment in satisfaction of this loan. And again, because the principal objective, the business strategy of TDS was to acquire this company, it certainly makes sense that what was contemplated, was an asset transfer, not simply a loan agreement. As to the Erickson claims, the assertion...
It's always called a loan. Do you agree that?
It is labeled a loan throughout, yes, sir.
I mean, this is complicated stuff, believe me. But
yes, sir.
Normally, I think when we look at something and it's described as a loan, we treat it as a loan, unless there's some reason why you would suspect that that's some kind of a phony label that's put on it, maybe a, you know, an insider deal. It's really a gift that somebody is going to say it's a loan so that you get certain more protection if it's a loan. So here, I'm having a difficult time trying to understand all of this stuff, but it seems like there is no reason to look behind this and recharacterize it as something other than a loan. Help me out about that.
Well, Your Honor, the first reason is that the label loan, the loan label, is not consistent with the substantive terms of the transaction. The reorganization plan doesn't contemplate any money repayment. There is a nominal rate of interest.
Why do you call it a loan?
Well, as to why TDS would characterize it as a loan, there is, I can only speculate. There are certainly several possible reasons. First, it matters very much in bankruptcy whether something is characterized as debt or equity. That has a substantial impact on the rights of the parties. Anyone advancing capital to a debtor at the risk of insolvency, or in fact one in reorganization with the prospect of the reorganization failing, has some incentive to characterize its claims as debt so that it can get precedence in bankruptcy, even if that's not the true character of the reorganization. It could be that the totality of this business plan required acquisition of the licenses. The ability to obtain the licenses was very much uncertain at that point in time, depending on a host of matters, including litigation about the FCC's right to cancel them, the FCC's exercise of discretionary authority to transfer them, and so forth. It may be that TDS simply wanted to hedge its bet by it being able to claim these as debts, unsecured debts, in the event it was not able to acquire all the assets that it wanted to acquire. It may be that there were tax ramifications to being able to write down this as a bad debt instead of a asset purchase agreement. I'm only speculating. I don't know, and I can't point you to anything in the record that will tell you, but there are certainly sound business reasons why even someone who has an arm's length relation to the debtor would want to manipulate the labels affixed to the transaction.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks to both counsel. The case will be taken under advisement.